You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
People who were children during the 1994 Rwandan genocide are grown up now and trying to find ways to handle the burden of the historical legacy they've inherited, but not always in ways that you might expect. For some of them, it means intense training and grueling fitness routines with hopes of succeeding in the world of professional road bike racing. Philip Gurevich, a longtime New Yorker writer, the former editor of the Paris Review and author of several books, joins us now. His recent article, Climbers, A Team of Young Cyclists Tries to Outrun the Past, appeared in the July 18th issue of the New Yorker and tells the story of Rwanda's bike racing team in which Hutus and Tutsis ride side by side as teammates. Hi, Philip. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be here.
How did the Rwandan cycling team first come about? Who started it?
It was there were bike racers in Rwanda more or less since there were bicycles, and although there's no documentation I could find, my sense is that bikes came over pretty soon after the first white men in the early 1900s. But the bike racing scene in Rwanda was informal, amateur, and driven by clubs that were organized in a loose federation. And then about 5-6 years ago, some American businessmen who were there and were mountain biking buffs at home started to look around the country and see these landscapes that are just very high, hilly, mountainous, dirt tracks running all through, very beautiful landscapes. And they thought, you know, we should bring some bikes over and start riding. And as they did, they started to really notice that everybody else was on the road on bikes. Their bikes, of course, were these old one-speed Chinese and Indian clunkers that had been re-welded and beaten to death and used for hauling freight. But the people on them could ride like mad. And so with a man named Tom Ritchie, who's one of the big bike designers and originators of mountain biking, and some of these businessmen and a few others, they came over to Rwanda to do two things. One was to try and introduce a better freight bicycle for hauling coffee and other crops out of the hills, a sort of pickup truck of bicycles, and see if they could make that catch on as a boost to the local economy. And at the same time, they organized this bike racing team and put an American coach in charge of trying to find the best young riders in the country.
Where did the first riders on the team come from? What were their lives like before they joined the team?
They were a lot of the riders on this team, and it's one of the things that made me really interested in it from the start, are people who came from the street, basically. They were people who had been, as very young men, often having lost one or several of their parents in Rwanda's war and genocides. They were working as bicycle taxi men and bicycle cargo riders, which is a pretty basic existence. They were earning anywhere from $2 to $4 or $5 a day, which is better than field labor, but obviously still pretty poor, and often supporting several family members from this. And the difference between them and let's say field laborers, maybe as a rule, is that some of them just really, really loved what they did. They loved the bike. And even when they didn't have passengers, they would be racing, and they would join these local races. And so when the team started to get organized, there were people who had been winning local races, and the word was sent out amongst them, and they would cell phone and text each other and say, hey, there's this American over here who's a coach who's testing people on a computer to join a national team. And the best riders started, they basically recruited each other, these guys.
Should we be surprised that it's made up of both Hutu and Tutsi riders?
No, because pretty much everything in Rwanda is mixed. I mean, the thing that is always striking is what you don't know at first is who's who. When you come to a team or a group of people in an office, in any operation, you know that it's mixed, but you, especially as an outsider or somebody who hasn't met them before, can't be sure at all who's who to begin with. And I had no sense of the makeup of the team. And one of the very interesting things is that Jock Boyer, the American coach, he's been living there for pretty much the better part of 5 years now. He's very involved in these young men's lives. And he only knew who some of them were by way of their personal backgrounds because he never asks. And in some ways, that's out of sensitivity to them. But he's always available to listen, but he never asks. So he doesn't know anything they don't tell him.
Well, how did people know in the past? Was it something on people's identity cards?
Yeah,
or could you
yeah.
tell by names?
No, by identity cards.
Do they have that on their identity cards now?
It was abolished immediately after the genocide. It was one of the first acts of the new post-genocide regime. And there had been, up till then, you would always have it on your identity card. And it was also something then that you spoke about very openly. You would say, he's a Hutu, he's a Tutsi, I'm a Hutu, you're a Tutsi. And that has become regulated. It became taboo. And certain kinds of reference to Hutu and Tutsi are prescribed by law. There are laws against genocide ideology and divisionism, which are so broad that they can be interpreted in different ways. So, in fact, when I go as a reporter and want to talk to people about Hutu and Tutsi, it's perfectly possible. I can talk to people. You just do it in a way that's gradual, and you approach it, and you make clear what you're talking about. You're talking about it in the past more than how it figures in the present in terms of understanding people's identity. But most people identify themselves first and foremost nowadays, at least publicly, as Rwandans. And if they're riding for a national team, part of what was interesting is there are a lot of other divisions in Rwandan life historically. And even in the run-up to the genocide, some of these mattered a lot, like regionalism. Rwanda's tiny. It's the size of West Virginia. And yet, being from the northwest as opposed to from the south, or the southeast in particular, was almost as big a difference at times as being Hutu or Tutsi. And these riders come from all over. They mix together. They stay together. And what binds them is their sport. And that was actually really interesting, because they have, once you start to look into their stories, you find out that they come from really, really different backgrounds.
Well, as I understand it, people who've been through traumatic events often don't want to talk about their experiences. What about these kids? Do they remember the events of their childhood and talk about them with each other?
Well, this is a fascinating thing about this particular slice. These are young men who are basically in their late teens to mid-20s. So the genocide was in 1994, 17 years ago, which means that they're basically were somewhere between, let's say, 4 or 5 and 8 or 9, 10 years old at most at that time. And so they have memories.
And some of them lost their parents and most of the members of their families.
Some lost most of the members of their families. And remember, Leonard, that before the genocide, there were years of civil war in Rwanda. And after the genocide, there was a sustained insurgency in part of Rwanda, in the northwest, that was a kind of renewed civil war for several years, where the forces of genocide came back into the country and staged a very destructive insurgency that was put down by a lot of violence from government soldiers. So in that part of the country, the northwest, where, as it happens, one sizable chunk of the team comes from, people suffered a great deal afterwards as well. And so it's the mix of these things. And also, what interested me about this generation is they have memories, although they also have a bit of the excuse of being able to say, I was young, I didn't really know what was going on, so to distance themselves from some of it. And I don't doubt that most of them comprehended it less well than, let's say, an adult would, even if they saw a great deal. But they all had an exposure to extreme violence. But they had, unlike people who are older than them, they had nothing to account for about it, either personally, individually, or collectively. It was something that happened to them as children and that was done by an older generation and that they themselves inherited, but in a sense, none of them have any particular shame for what happened or even a sense of it having been done to them in a personal way. They're living on the other side of it and absorbing it in a different way.
Well, in Germany, the younger generation was horrified by what their parents and grandparents had done and seemed to have totally rejected all of those ideas and moved in a totally different direction. Is that the case in Rwanda?
It's obviously more complex there because, there are many, many historical differences both before and after the genocide. But the most obvious thing that makes Rwanda unique in this kind of mass atrocity period is the intimacy both of the way the killing took place and of the way that people lived together afterwards. In Germany, the Germans who rejected and sort of searched their soul as a nation were not doing so in the company of the Jewish survivors. They were doing it unless they sought them out somewhere else, but they certainly weren't living all intermingled. In Rwanda, it's much more intimate, and the whole history of the last 17 years has been this very complicated, sometimes more successful than at other times, attempt to knit these communities back together, oblige them to live together, first of all, force them to confront each other somewhat through these gachacha courts where they adjudicated some of the genocide cases, subject them to a certain amount of commemorative exercises, create certain taboos also, because the idea is that if you talk too much about these things publicly, it keeps it raw, so maybe it's better to suppress it, which is highly debated, obviously. And so there's been this process for all of them, but there's a guy I write about a lot in the story, a guy named Gasori, who is one of the newer riders on the team, but one of the really strong ones. And he came from the most harsh background, which is that he was a street kid. His parents had both died by the time he was 10. And he was living on the street as a homeless child, basically, and managed to, through hard work, save up for a bicycle. And he had a very complicated story. He was a Hutu. He didn't tell me at first much about what had happened. He said he didn't remember much, but bit by bit the story came out, and he talked about how he had left and fled to Congo with the others and come back to his neighborhood. His father had been killed by government soldiers during the insurgency. But he said, you know, all of this history of the genocide and these wars, that's an affair of the old people. And it really, it's not what's my life is about. And I realized that although at first he'd basically denied some of his past or not told me his story, he'd told me a different story. It wasn't so much that he was trying to lie and tell me a false story, it's that he was trying to give me a simple explanation of what's meaningful to him in his life, which is he made his own way. And I think that that's a big part of what you see in this team, is both the Hutu and the Tutsi riders, what they share as athletes and as young men who are really trying to sort of drive themselves forward, is a horror of being defined by the victimization of the past and a desire to make themselves in some new form.
That,
in a sense, is something they have in common with athletes everywhere.
Another writer that you gave some special attention to in the article is Adrian Nyanshuti. What is his story?
Adrian's really the star of the whole cycling scene in Rwanda. He is the first Rwandan to actually get signed up outside of Rwanda, not riding for the Rwandan team anymore. He got hired by the MTN cycling team, which is the biggest professional team in South Africa, and he lives in Johannesburg now, and he trains with them, and he, in fact, just qualified as a mountain biker to ride in the London 2012 Olympics, which is a huge event for a country that had so few athletes of any stature before. But he is a genocide survivor, and he came from a family, in his case there were a lot of athletes in his family, but he came from a really large family, and unlike some of his teammates who really came from poverty and the streets, he sometimes says even though he lost more than 40 members of his family during the genocide, his immediate family, and of his 9 siblings originally, he and one brother who's now a peacekeeper in Darfur are the only ones who survive. Well, there's a sister who's was badly maimed during the genocide and is an invalid. And his mother survived, but that's it. So he's very alone. Even so, he said, in some ways, my life was never as hard as theirs, because he had a family that had some money. They had a farm. They were able to support themselves reasonably. They were hardly rich, but they were what we would call middle-class farmers. His father was also a tailor. And he had a bike from a young age to go to school on. And he started just riding all the time after school. He would just ride for hours and hours. And he finally entered a race as a teenager. And he was doing pretty well in school, and his family wanted them to stay in school. But he won this race, and he got the taste for it. He had had an uncle who had been, before the genocide, a bike champion in Rwanda in the amateur scene. And so there was that idea existed in his head, where for somebody like Gasori, it was completely imagined originally for himself out of his own dreams. For Adrian, there was this idea of almost a family tradition of athletics, and he put himself into it. But He talked a lot about his experience during the genocide during in 1994, and as a small boy fleeing with his parents, first hiding in the bush. And then they had a very interesting story, which is during the Civil War, as Hutus were displaced by the fighting, his family had taken in a Hutu family. They were Muslims. Adrian is a Muslim and a very observant one. And it's a small community of Muslims in Rwanda, but they looked after their own. And they took this Hutu family in. And then during the genocide, the Hutu family took them in. And they continued to live together for at least a decade after the genocide in adjacent houses, first in the same house and then in adjacent houses. And so he has both the harshest form of memory of the genocide and a deeper understanding, as many Rwandans do, of the complexity of the categories. You know, that it's not about Hutu versus Tutsi, it's about some versus others, and it's about the people who saved you belong to the group of the people who killed you. The family that took him in, his family in, their son was the chief of the militias in the area where they came from. And so he wasn't at home, obviously. He was off killing Tutsis elsewhere. But when the family took them in, their house then got attacked by the same sorts of militias that their son was leading. It's that complicated, and it's some of that complexity that you start to see being woven into the understanding of how a new generation makes a new experience.
Philip Gurevich has written an article that was in the July 18th issue of The New Yorker called Climbers, a Team of Young Cyclists Tries to Outrun the Past. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Philip Gurevich's article, Climbers, a Team of Young Cyclists Tries to Outrun the Past, appeared in the July 18th issue of The New Yorker. A listener writes on our website, Philip, in this country, and probably in most of the Western world, people who are the result of a white parent and black parent are generally considered black. Is the child of a mixed Hutu-Tutsi parentage considered to be one or the other?
Historically, it would usually be patrilineal. So you were known as what your father was, and that would be how it worked in the time of ID cards. But for the most part, if you talked to such a person, they would usually tell you, if you said, you know, sort of what's your background or how were you identified, they might say, well, I was identified by my father, but we were mixed, because they would have the experience of living in these two families. I mean, the whole nature of these identities is so complex, the construction of them. I mean, they don't really fit any conventional definition of an ethnic identity because they speak the same language, they live intermingled, they eat the same foods, there's no religious differentiation between their practices. I mean, you have Protestants, Catholics, Muslims, animists, etc. throughout their history, but they're mixed.
Well, in the old days, we always thought that the Tutsis were the taller people because
they're physiological archetypes, and yet they, you know, I've seen lots of tall, skinny Hutus and short, fat Tutsis in my time there. And, you know, it's just too easy to think you know what you're dealing with. And so, I mean, what I find is the way that in a conversation, these taboos that now exist, obviously Rwandans know who's who. They know who's who because they know who they're talking to. They have various coded ways of being able to identify very quickly where somebody comes from. And what I've found is if you're talking to somebody and you start talking to them about the past and about the genocide period, almost certainly if they are a Tutsi survivor, they will identify themselves as a genocide survivor because that's essentially Rwanda's story, a country that survived genocide. It's the official story, and it's their story, and they're not ashamed of it. It's not awkward. It's not complicated. A person who is not a survivor, after a little while, you realize, oh, this person has not identified themselves in any way as a survivor of the genocide or a victim of the attacks on Tutsis. Therefore, probably they come from a Hutu background, though that doesn't tell you anything about where they were or what was going on.
Now, this is, to a large degree, all of Rwanda, a story of redemption. But it's also that's also something that applies to the coach, doesn't it? Jonathan Boyer, called Jock.
Yeah, I mean,
who spent time in prison.
He did. When I started taking an interest in the team and meeting some of these riders last year, I didn't realize this, but then I learned, because it wasn't a secret, I just did some Googling and so forth. And Jock Boyer was the first American cyclist to ride in the Tour de France. in the 1980s. He rode five times. He placed as high as 12th, and he won the race across America. He was a kind of giant of the cycling scene in the 80s and early 90s, and he lived in Europe for a long time. And he's a very appealing man who was doing something quite remarkable in Rwanda. And then I learned that he had gone to jail in about 10 years ago now, for the charge was lewd acts with a minor. He'd had some kind of a sexual encounter with a young teenage girl in California where he lived. And so I obviously said to him, you know, is this something we could talk about, because I'm going to have to address it. And obviously, in talking to him, but also to others around him who knew him, the question of, you know, how much is what he's doing in Rwanda now a kind of good works, an attempt to redeem having done something wrong? And he never, by the way, he never denied it. He immediately, when confronted about it, and the girl mentioned it in a way that went to the police, I guess, five years after the event, and he immediately admitted it, confessed, was given a relatively light sentence, has never been seen by anybody as a threat to other young people. It was a sort of, he describes it as an anomaly in his history. And, you know, one of the questions is this a story of redemption? Or it made me think a lot about what redemption is. And there's some offenses that can't really be forgiven in a certain way, certainly not by any of us who weren't part of them, who weren't the victim of them. And they can't really be made right, is what I mean.
Well, how did he wind up with this job? Was this something that...
Through
his
friends who were the guys who started the team.
He was trying to escape his past, or was this something that he was reluctant to do at first?
He was reluctant. The story is that Tom Ritchie, the American mountain bike maker who went over there in the first place and had the idea, let's start this team with one of his friends, Dan Cooper, they said, you know, Jock would be great at this, and let's try and get Jock interested. And Jock, at that point, he was not trying to flee. If you think about somebody who has had a sex offender rap, you think, well, what might you do? You'd probably move to some other community. No, he lived in Carmel, California, where he'd lived all his life, and he moved right back in. He was living in his mother's house. He was running a bike shop. He wasn't trying to hide. He went right back into the professional bike racing world. He did a race across America and reasserted himself at the age of 50 as a very powerful rider. So he Jock, says, I definitely did not come to Rwanda looking for any kind of redemption. He resisted it. He didn't know anything about Rwanda at that time. He had lived, he was known even on the Tour de France as a guy who kept very much to himself. He was a reborn Christian long before he got into any trouble or had any issues. He was on the tour. He was a vegetarian health nut and kept to himself in many ways. And he was once again just keeping his head down and keeping to himself. And these guys are like, you got to come to Rwanda. You got to come to Rwanda. So he went to Rwanda, and he was very moved by these young men. And particularly he met Adrian Neonshuti, the guy who's going to the Olympics, whom we were talking about just before, the survivor. He didn't know anything about their stories, really. What he saw were people who came from next to nothing with bikes that barely functioned and who had a kind of raw power and determination that he thought you could make something of. And it's not a line I actually ended up using in the piece in a way, but Jock, as a young man, as a boy, his parents had divorced. He was born in Utah and then raised in California by his mother. And he really didn't see his father from the age of six for decades, or a decade and a half at least. And he told me at one point, you know, what I really related to here was just how many people here were missing parents, and particularly fathers.
Philip Gurevich is the author of an article called Climbers, A Team of Young Cyclists Tries to Outrun the Past, which appeared in the July 18th issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Where does this Rwandan team compete? Do they ever compete outside of Rwanda? And how do they stack up? You mentioned earlier that Adrian is now with a South African team, which I assume means he was good enough to get onto a better team.
Yeah, he is. The South African team is really the top professional team in sub-Saharan Africa, the team that he's on. And Jock, one of the things that Jock did from the very beginning is he saw you can't really learn to be a bike racer unless you're racing a lot. And there aren't enough races in this country. So early on, I tell the story in the piece of he took them on a trip to America for 3 months and put them through all these races that were really sort of almost crushingly eye-opening for these young riders just to realize what it was like to be up against people of great technical ability and superior practice and superior discipline and also equipment. And, you know, many of these riders, we talked about how they came from very poor backgrounds, could neither read nor write. Think about in this country, Leonard, if somebody starts to become a bike buff in their teens, they're going to be immediately reading bike magazines, bike websites, learning about gear ratios and the math and the gear and reading catalogs. These guys don't have access to that. Even if they can get online, they can't read. So they look at videos and things, and Jock started sending them to training centers in South Africa, international training centers. He started putting them on planes and getting them going, and he would take them to these tours, these 8, 9, 10 stage races in West Africa, the Tour of Cameroon, the Tour of Ivory Coast, the Tour of Morocco, the Tour of Egypt, the Tour of Algeria. He would go up to North Africa with them, where you'd encounter all kinds of different conditions, both geographical and sociopolitical. I mean, he has some hilarious stories of these races where, you know, race organizers made off with the money and there was nothing to eat and bikes got stolen and there were fist fights. And the Rwandan riders would be competing against an international team then. They're in Brazil at the Tour de Rio. So he's taking them more and more into this international place. How do they stack up? They do a lot better than most people would expect considering their experience, and they've started to win more and more stages and more elements. They're not very good at the team strategy yet, but in terms of individual power, they're particularly good, and it's one of the reasons that many of them are drawn to mountain biking, because it's more of an individualistic sport than a sport where you have to coordinate the strategy with others.
Isn't there now a Tour of Rwanda?
The Tour of Rwanda has existed for a while, and in about 4 or 5 years ago, it got knitted into the international. There's this thing called the Union, the International Cyclists Union, the UCI, which officiates over the whole global international cycling calendar and qualifies your points for different races. And the Rwanda Tour is now part of that.
Now, a listener writes in that you put the benefits of working together in terms of the men on these teams. Is there any social institution doing something similar for women in Rwanda? And what is the situation for women these days? Hello, Philip? Well, I think we've lost Philip Gurevich, but Philip? I guess not. Well, Philip, thank you so much for participating in our show today and telling us about what's going on in Rwanda with this team that you've written about in The New Yorker called Climbers. Oh, Philip?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, are you back? You're back.
I must have bumped a button.
I was asking whether what's the situation for women these days?
There isn't a women's team at the same level, but they've been recruiting them now, and I just actually this week got an email from Jock that he had just tested a bunch of new women riders and that there were a couple that were really starting to impress him, and he has real hope about that.
What about other sports? I think we lost you again. Okay, well, we're pretty much at the end of this conversation anyway, and my great thanks to Philip Gurevich. The article, Climbers, A Team of Young Cyclists Tries to Outrun the Past, appeared in the July 18th issue of The New Yorker. Philip, next time I'd love to have you in the studio. We won't have this kind of problem.